CITR 101.9 FM presents News 101, Vancouver's volunteer-produced student and community newscast. Now, here are your hosts, Katie Conley and Jeff Sargent.
Good evening. Coming up on the program, the City of Vancouver is looking to ban plastic bag use.
Vancouver taxpayers may not be receiving a refund from the civic strike after all.
And on commentary, Phil Caudry discusses the crime bill proposed by the Conservatives as a good first step to cracking down on the proliferation of drugs and organized crime in Canada.
We'll have all this plus arts and your weekend weather forecast coming up in the next hour right here on News 101.
But first, we'll begin with a piece from our friends from Radio Free UBC.
Today on Radio Free UBC, we've got an interview with T and Elise, the coordinators of UBC's Buy Nothing Day. We've also got a recap of last week's Campus and Community Planning Committee meeting for the Board of Governors. Radio Free UBC has T and Elise in the studio today. They are the coordinators for this year's Buy Nothing Day at UBC. What is Buy Nothing Day?
I'll take this one, T. Buy Nothing Day is pretty much started by Adbusters in Vancouver, and it's actually grown. It's an international day now, and it takes place on the Friday after American Thanksgiving every single year because that is the biggest shopping day in the country, and it's just a moratorium on consumerism just to get people thinking about what they're buying, how what they're buying is affecting the world, the environment, everything like that.
Cool. Do you think that such initiatives like just promoting like a day where you're not supposed to buy anything is effective in terms of getting people to think about their consumption purchases?
We're not saying that you've got to go hungry for the day. If you need to buy a drink, we'd suggest maybe drinking out of a fountain instead of buying a bottle of water, for instance. So, our sheer inability to go a single day without buying something is pretty telling about society.
Yeah, I think mainly it's just like a challenge to people. Sometimes you just have to kind of just have a whole day without... I've been struggling today. Like, I've been hungry, and I'm like, what do I do? But yeah, so it's just a big challenge. It's just kind of get people thinking. If you were just to have a day where you're like, think about what you're buying, but you can still buy things, it just doesn't have that same effect. So it's just kind of that kind of thing. And then hopefully in the future, we didn't want to just have it one day of buying nothing. We wanted it for, okay, so after this one day, when you're going about go buy things, to actually think about what you're buying and that kind of thing. So it's just to kind of get you thinking.
Cool. So one of the things about having Buy Nothing Day on the day after Thanksgiving or the Friday before the American Thanksgiving is that it is supposedly the most popular day in North America for buying stuff for Christmas, I guess, for the upcoming holiday season where a lot of gifts are to be exchanged. Do you not like Christmas or holidays around that time?
I love Christmas, but mainly just because I think it's a time when we can all get together with our families, and not necessarily Christmas, all holidays around that time of year, but it's the main purpose of it is to get together with your family, chill out, have a little bit of a vacation. It's not to have little kids screaming that they didn't get an iPod that year kind of thing. So I think it's just, like, it's a great holiday, but I think it's just turned into this big consumerism thing that just doesn't have to be. So.
We totally need to question more the commercialization of, I don't know, holidays. What does Christmas stand for these days? Those amongst us who aren't particularly religious, like, what does this day mean to us? I absolutely enjoy the holiday season for, you know, like, family reasons and whatnot, but it's getting ridiculous as an excuse to buy. You end up having to buy junk, perhaps, like, for, I don't know, to trade amongst your family kind of thing. It's just not stacking up, and it's just corporate profit is what the holidays turned into.
So some of the events that you've had today, you had a stuff swap. Can you tell me about the stuff swap and how often it happens at UBC?
Sure. The Stuff Swap is put on by the Student Environment Center, and it happens the last Friday of every single month. This month we moved it back, so it could be on Buy Nothing Day. But basically the idea of it's just for people to bring in their old junk and for other people to hopefully find something that they could actually use. Instead of just throwing out things that you don't want anymore, you never know when someone could actually use it.
Cool. So the Stuff Swap is more about creating sort of an alternative means of exchange where money isn't necessarily the means for exchange. It's more just... yeah, finding stuff that you need and getting rid of stuff that you may not find as useful anymore.
Yeah, exactly.
Nice. Another thing that I saw, you screened manufactured landscapes, or what other kinds of events went on today?
It was just kind of mainly promotion outside. We're actually pretty fortunate to get some photos by Chris Jordan, who's an awesome photographer, and he takes a lot of photos, I think, around the Seattle area, if I'm not mistaken. We just have, like, a big recycling yard photo put out there. Also, he does, like, this graphic design where he takes statistics and puts them into photos. So we had this awesome one that showed, is it 2 million bottles? Plastic bottles, like Coke bottles and water bottles, are used in the U.S. every 5 minutes, and just really shocking photos just to kind of get the word out there to show people that we are producing waste and what we're buying is having an effect. I think one of the main things with our society is that we don't know where all the stuff we buy goes. We put it in a garbage can or we put it in a recycling bin, but we don't see the landfills every day. And I think that's something that's really big, that is a reason that we just don't really care about what we're consuming. So it's good to kind of show the public what's going on.
Yeah, the photos were definitely pretty effective.
Again, the whole Buy Nothing Day concept, it's not to be taken to its literal extreme necessarily. And so what the day's events and sort of goals have been about is just really to get people to think about what they're buying, how they could buy more responsibly, how they could reduce their consumption, because there's a lot of, it's directed more at frivolous purchase, which is, you know, we're all guilty of, and do we really need to buy these things sometimes? Yeah, so the photos have been stopping people in their tracks. In my opinion, bottled water is an offence on so many levels. It's the most ridiculous product in existence in basically industrialized societies. It's unnecessary, and we should be drinking tap water. And the Chris Jordan image, get along to his website, chrisjordan.com, and have a look. And, yeah, it'll shock you to see the number of bottles we gather in 5 minutes in North America.
Cool. Well, thanks a lot for coming to the studio today, and I wish you the best of luck with buying nothing and thinking about your purchases.
Great, thanks.
Thank you.
On Wednesday, November 28th, starting at about 8 a.m., there's going to be the bi-monthly Board of Governors meeting. One of the most contentious decisions being made is in regards to the University Boulevard development project. Ongoing coverage at Radio Free has outlined how the initial plans are to build a shopping mall with an underground bus loop underneath. The project, as it stands, has a few key features. Number one, it costs over $40 million. And two, the cost recovery model upon which the project is based will take over 25 years. This is only with an optimal profit-generating plan. The two main components of the project, namely a shopping mall and housing, well, I guess in addition to the underground bus loop, are strongly contested. Apparently, some people want to keep the center of campus an open and public area and not corporate headquarters costing over $40 million.
After major student pressure in May, the university decided to consult students about center campus. The results have just come back this month, and the consultations show that students almost unanimously oppose the old plan for market housing and a shopping mall. Early this week, the revised plans, the post-consultation plans, were presented to the Board of Governors. What happened at that meeting was that the unelected members complained about the revisions after the consultation process itself. They argued that the only way to make the area affordable for the university was to have the university ignore the student consultation results and build revenue-generating retail and housing in the area. Right-wing administrators like Brad Bennett and Bryce Rossich complained of another possible $6 million budget deficit. What students should know about this is that the bus loop itself will cost $40 million. Importantly, the bus loop was not included in the consultation process and is therefore a unilateral project of a hardcore handful of Board of Governors and university administrators.
And thanks as always to Radio Free UBC for that piece. Now with a look at other local news, here are Leanne Yu and Carrie Baptist.
The city of Vancouver may be the next city to join in on the plastic bag ban. Two city councillors are proposing a new bylaw that will prohibit the sale of single-use plastic bags at large retailers. This follows other similar moves in cities such as San Francisco. The city says it is doing research right now and looking into alternatives and the impacts a possible ban could have. But some retailers are not very enthusiastic about the potential ban. Gary Sands, vice president of the Canadian Federation of Independent Grocers, says the issue is very complicated. He argues that it's unrealistic to try to eliminate the use of plastic bags. Sands would prefer to follow the Ontario model, where retailers are working with the government to encourage consumers to buy cloth bags. But many argue this isn't enough. If the ban is passed here in Vancouver, shoppers would be forced to bring their own bags to stores or buy reusable cloth or plastic bags. Reports from other areas who have implemented bans show dramatic decreases in plastic bags littering coastlines and streets.
The city's trolley buses are back on today after frost on the overhead wires brought bus service to a halt Thursday morning. To prevent the situation from occurring again this morning, TransLink drivers spent last night's off hours driving around Metro Vancouver to keep the overhead wires warm. TransLink spokesman Drew Snyder says the problem occurred because heavy frost on the lines caused the new bus's computer systems to think there is no power, leading the buses to automatically detach their poles from the overhead wires. However, the overnight drivers are just a temporary solution. Snyder couldn't say when the problem will be fixed or how much drivers are paid to work overnight. He adds the longer-term solution is to work with technology on the bus. TransLink is working on pinpointing the problem and finding a solution from there.
Following up on our story about Buy Nothing Day from earlier in the show, we have some other information about the day. Buy Nothing Day was started here in Vancouver in 1992 by Adbusters magazine and coincides with Black Friday in the U.S., the day after American Thanksgiving, when hordes of shoppers attack the malls hoping for early Christmas deals. People in 65 countries take part in Buy Nothing Day, demonstrating against overconsumption.
Langara College students will soon be taking part in the UPass Transit Program. Students at Langara voted in favor of joining the UPass program, making them the first college in the Lower Mainland to take part in the program, joining UBC and Simon Fraser. A fee of $150 will be added to student fees per semester in return for an unlimited three-zone transit pass.
Days after this summer's strike by Vancouver civic workers began, City Council passed a motion promising to pass any savings on to taxpayers. However, Vancouverites waiting for a refund after 3 months without garbage collection might be out of luck. A report on the strike estimated the city saved $1.2 million on garbage collection cost. That translates into $8 per household if the city was to pass these savings on directly to taxpayers. However, city engineers are now claiming the real savings from the strike were negligible because the garbage, which accumulated during the strike, had to be collected eventually anyway. Council will not be passing strike savings on to homeowners. Instead, it's considering a recommendation that would see fees for garbage collection increase, with the annual fee for collection going up by $6 to $105 per container. City staffers argue the increase is needed because of increasing wage, fuel, and equipment costs for garbage pickup. All right, we're going to take a quick break now, but stay tuned to CITR for more news following these public service announcements.
Want to know what's going on around town? LiveMusicVancouver.com is the Lower Mainland's comprehensive source for live music listings. We've got more than 350 shows listed at any time, and our listings are updated continuously by hundreds of the very people who put on the shows you love. Artist information and MP3s are accessible right from the listings, as are maps and calendars for virtually every venue in the city. All this and tons more totally free at LiveMusicVancouver.com.
All you people care about is readers and making money off of her. She's a human! Leave Brittany alone!
If you don't want to miss your favorite CITR show because it makes fun of the spiel, then you've got nothing to worry about. Now you can get all of the CITR 101.9 FM radio shows off our website and download them straight onto your computer or MP3 players. Just visit www.citr.ca/podcast and dive into a pool of all of the past radio shows, such as...
Because all you people want is more, 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 more! Leave her alone!
All to your little heart's desire.
This is News 101, and the current time is 5:16. Now, with a look at other BC news, we're joined in studio by News 101 reporters Leanne Yu and Rita Farkas.
Residents of Goldbridge, a small community 100 kilometers west of Lillooet, are contemplating class action against BC Hydro. Last Thursday, a power surge ran through the community of 40 people, causing nearly all electrical devices and appliances to blow out. Goldbridge Hotel bartender Judy Hartman says the hotel's compact fluorescent light bulbs blew out and pieces of glass were lodged into the walls and floors. She adds people could have been injured by the blowout. But BC Hydro spokesperson Jillian Robinson says the weather, not the company, is to blame. She says high winds were what caused the surge, not corporate negligence. Robinson adds the event was beyond Hydro's control, and the company does not accept liability for losses or injuries as a result of problems, failures, or defects in the delivery of electricity.
Two homeless people in Kelowna were harassed Thursday morning by having buckets of paint poured on them. The act, which was partially caught on surveillance video, happened at 1 a.m. while the homeless pair was sleeping in an alleyway. The video showed three males getting out of a black SUV, two of which were carrying five-gallon paint cans. The paint was quickly dumped on the unsuspecting victims. The three men then ran back to the truck and drove away. The homeless people were seen trying to clean up, but ultimately throwing most of their blankets and clothes into a dumpster. Selena Steams, manager of the Kelowna Drop-In and Information Center, says similar attacks on the homeless began 7 months ago. She adds there have been a number of people waking up to find fire extinguishers put in their mouths and then turned on. Others have been shot by paintballs, hit with bear spray, eggs, and even feces. The victims say they don't want to be identified but hope the release of the video will spark an investigation.
A First Nations Education Act has been introduced to the provincial legislature. Education Minister Shirley Bond introduced the measure, which would give First Nations more control over Native education and curriculum. Bond explained that the legislation enables on-reserve First Nations schools to have their own kindergarten to grade 12 education system, which are based on provincial curriculum learning outcomes. She says it enables participating First Nations who have granted their own graduation certificates to apply to have students receive this provincial graduation certificate called the Dogwood Certificate. Currently, there are 6,100 students in 130 Native schools.
Thanks, Leanne, and we're going to take another break now, but when we come back, we'll update you on national and international news. Stay with us. News 101 will continue right after this.
Are you a UBC student taking first-year economics, math, chemistry, or physics?
That stuff is hard.
Are you feeling like you need some tutoring? That's okay, because the AMS offers free and appointment tutoring for students in these subjects.
Whoa! How does it work?
It's on a first-come, first-served basis, and there's no need to sign up. Just show up with your books and your questions.
Whoa! When does it happen?
Monday to Thursday from 3 to 7 at the Sub Pacific Spirit Cafeteria, located beside the Starbucks.
Whoa! A+, here I come.
Boy, I'm glad we paid our electric bill.
Electricity is our servant in many ways.
Uh-oh, here we go again.
Oh, Terry, I'm interested. Where does electricity come from, Jasper?
I'm sorry I mentioned it.
Well, electricity can come from many places, from many different sources of power, like hydroelectric power.
Hydroelectric?
Hydro means water. Water power to make electricity.
Want to learn more? Join Team PowerSmart. Visit bchydro.com/teampowersmart to make a difference and conserve today. Influence the future of energy conservation in BC by entering BC Hydro's Innovation Challenge, open exclusively to participating post-secondary institutions in BC. You could win one of three cash prizes. Visit bchydro.com/innovationchallenge before November 30th to find out more.
That you can join for free, and kids in every neighborhood belong. It's a funny company, cause it's just for fun, you see. So come on running when you hear our song.
521 and the news continues on CITR.
A line of frozen beef burgers has been recalled by the Canadian Food Inspection Agency over concerns that they may be contaminated with E. coli. The CFIA and manufacturer Cardinal Meat Specialists warns the public not to consume any of the frozen burgers, which are marketed under the Compliments and Cardinal Roadhouse brands, as well as Longo's. All the products were distributed nationally, and there have been no reported illnesses from eating them as of yet. Foods contaminated by E. coli don't appear spoiled, but bacteria can cause serious and potentially life-threatening illnesses, with symptoms including severe abdominal pain and bloody diarrhea.
At this week's Commonwealth Summit in Uganda, Prime Minister Stephen Harper is standing alone against a united front of nations who are calling for action against climate change. One of the goals of this year's summit was reaching a consensus on the fate of the Kyoto Protocol before it is discussed during December's United Nations meeting in Bali, Indonesia. Stephen Harper, leader of one of the heavyweight Commonwealth nations, is opposing the adoption of protocols binding targets on greenhouse gas emissions. According to reports, British Prime Minister Gordon Brown and other diplomats will try to persuade Harper to sign the Commonwealth Agreement. If not, the Commonwealth delegation will arrive in Bali with a slightly more watered-down statement than they had intended. Canada and Australia, whose Prime Minister John Howard was the only leader not to attend the summit, are the only countries out of the 53 Commonwealth nations to oppose the resolution.
The federal government is setting aside two large areas of boreal forest and tundra in Canada's north for the creation of two new national parks. The creation of the parks is part of Ottawa's plan to withdraw the massive areas from industrial development in order to protect what Environment Minister John Byrd calls some of the most impressive ecological and cultural wonders in the north. Collectively covering close to 10 million hectares, the first park will be situated along the Arctic Circle in an area called Ramparts River and Wetlands, with the second park covering a section on the eastern arm of Great Slave Lake. The move has been praised by environmentalists and First Nations leaders alike. Frank Seeley, a member of the local Dene Nation, says that the area is not only home to many endangered species, but also to the history of his people. Lauren Johnson, director of the Ottawa branch of the World Wildlife Federation, says that while normally they have been critical of the Conservatives' environmental record, the creation of the parks is a massive accomplishment that they applaud.
In international news, the International Panel on Climate Change released its final report last Saturday. The report will hopefully give policymakers some direction to mitigate climate change impacts. The release will be followed by a summit in Bali on December 3rd, where leaders will pick up where Kyoto... On December 3rd, where leaders will pick up where Kyoto left off. FSRN's Jess Burns reports.
On Saturday, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change released a major report summarizing all their findings on global warming released in the last year. The report not only coalesced the scientific aspects of the United Nations-sponsored work, but it creates a roadmap for policymakers to mitigate the impacts of climate change. The IPCC released the synthesis report ahead of a summit on climate change scheduled to begin on December 3rd in Bali, Indonesia. The Indonesian meetings are intended to pick up where the Kyoto Protocol left off. Democratic Senator John Kerry says a congressional delegation is planning to attend the meeting to show there are forces in the United States that support the organization's work.
We plan to represent the increasingly consensus view in the Senate and the House that our country, the United States, needs to lead on this issue, intends to lead on the issue, and that we need to act to reduce our CO2 emissions.
To get some perspective on the impact of the IPCC's synthesis report and a preview of the Bali meeting, I spoke with Angela Anderson, the Vice President of Climate Programs at the National Environmental Trust. She says the new report highlights the urgency of climate change in a way that has not been previously presented. There's a phrase that I've read has caused quite a bit of discussion among IPCC scientists, and that is the idea that climate change is abrupt and irreversible. What are the implications here?
Well, I think what they're talking about is that
there is the possibility that if the right string of events came together, dealing with the melting of the ice sheets in Greenland and other places, that you could have really a catastrophic event that would accelerate the warming of the Earth so fast that those impacts would be virtually unavoidable. So I think there is some concern about about scientists, about both the likelihood of that happening, and some felt the need to highlight the fact that it is possible, and others, I think, who are wanting not to be overly alarmist because it's a possibility and not a certainty, were less willing to include that language. At the end of the day, I believe it stayed in, and I think it's helpful for people to understand that, you know, we're really gambling here with our future. It's possible we won't have any abrupt events, but there is that outside chance that something cataclysmic could happen.
How do you see this new report being utilized at the upcoming Bali Climate Summit?
Well, I think it's no surprise that Secretary General Ban Ki-moon was it's no accident that he was at the IPCC conference. He really views that report as setting the stage not only for what happens in Bali in the next few weeks, but also for the next 3 years, that world leaders have got to come together on an international agreement that the U.S. participates in, along with developing countries, that will effectively stem the emissions tide. And it's really the activity that's going to get launched in Bali, and those negotiations are really going to determine whether or not globally we can avert the worst consequences of climate change.
Do you think the United States is actually going to step up?
It's terrible when you have to say that the best case scenario is that they don't block. And I think that's what we're looking at, is that we think it's quite possible that the United States will not block progress or the outline of a framework for negotiations, and that in and of itself would be progress. I think the other thing we're going to see is that world leaders are not only going to be looking to this administration, but they're going to be looking at Congress and they're going to be looking at the states, and they're beginning to understand that that the administration is really out of step with what's happening in other parts of American life. So that is encouraging to the world leaders. I think as long as the White House doesn't throw some big roadblocks in the setting up of a negotiating framework, that they'll get started, and hopefully the U.S. Under a new administration will be much more cooperative.
Angela Anderson is the Vice President of Climate Programs at the National Environmental Trust.
And thanks to Free Speech Radio News for making that piece available for rebroadcast. It's time now for another break here on News 101, but stay tuned for commentary and much more coming up on the other side.
Years in a Chinese jail for sending an email.
Threats against a mother in Honduras because she spoke up for justice.
Jail, torture, and rape for a student election worker in the Congo.
On Human Rights Day, December 10, Amnesty International gives you the power to stop these abuses.
Go to amnesty.ca. Join our global write-a-thon for justice and freedom. Write for rights at amnesty.ca.
Do you want to gain a greater understanding for global affairs and the inner workings of the international diplomacy? Now's your chance for UBC Model United Nations Forum. It is a simulated conference and the largest in Western Canada, renowned for its high quality of debate, emphasis on principled negotiation, and diverse delegate selection. UBC MUN is rapidly becoming the world's most innovative student forum due to its topical committee simulations and unparalleled global focus. To sign up or for more information, please visit the IRSA website at irsa.ca.
And welcome back to News 101. It's now time for commentary, and this week, Phil discusses the Conservatives' new crime prevention bill.
The Conservative Party of Canada fronted a new crime bill that would impose the country's first mandatory minimum prison sentences on anyone convicted of trafficking illegal drugs. The Tories stated that they hoped the proposed legislation would eventually crack down on drug dealers and transform the lives of addicts who wanted to get clean. The proposed bill would see a mandatory minimum of 2 years for individuals dealing hard drugs such as cocaine and heroin to youth. Those running large marijuana grow operations of at least 500 plants would also receive similar penalties. Moreover, penalties for trafficking of controlled substances such as GHB, commonly known as date rape drugs, would be toughened. The Tories also had special items in the bill to fight organized crime's role in the proliferation of illegal substances. The legislation would see mandatory jail sentences of 1 year for selling marijuana as part of an organized crime gang or when a weapon was involved. Critics of the bill think that, while the Conservatives try to get tougher on crime, there will be an increase in violent crime between drug gangs, and the Canadian prison system will be bursting at the seams. Craig Jones of the John Howard Institute posits that the bill is a prison growth strategy, as additional tax dollars will be required to cope with the increase in convicts locked in prisons. Additionally, Jones argues that the bill will lead to gangs shedding more blood among each other due to an increased tougher climate to sell drugs. While legitimate concerns, the facts speak for themselves. In the Lower Mainland alone, there is already a bloodbath among gangs. The police have essentially lost control of the city, and the revolving door of the judicial system does not help matters. Building more prisons tends to be associated with more crime, but in this case it is simply more criminals not getting away with their criminal activity. Mandatory minimums tend to be terrible for drug users, but for drug dealers this is a great idea. By ensuring hard drug dealers are off the streets for a couple of years, it will disrupt criminal organizations and give authorities an opportunity to play catch-up in a battle that they are sorely losing. The most compelling part of mandatory sentences being imposed is that there is a treatment component offered for nonviolent offenders not involved in organized crime. This would enable convicts to shave off time their sentencing if the treatment was completed. This will immediately become a crime prevention tool. So while the Tories have failed to act on taking steps to legalize some recreational drugs, which would eliminate much of the criminal component associated with them, it is a large first step in cracking down on suppliers who laugh their way out of the doors of the judicial system, and also in coming to the aid of addicts. For News 101 Commentary, I'm Phil Caudry.
And thanks for that, Phil. Our foreign correspondent Peter Otis comes to us now with a piece on the rise of the Canadian loonie from the perspective of a foreign exchange student.
On the surface, what's happening right now is in no way different than when I moved here to Copenhagen in August of this year. I'm just down my local street here at the ATM, taking out my bank card out of my wallet. And there it is. Let's see, I stick it in. And I choose, I want to take out 500 kroner. There's my cart, and the money's on its way. But there is a huge difference, and I can feel it most when I'm at the grocery store. I had never realized how relatively inexpensive food was back in Canada. To give you an idea, take almost any item, double the price, and that'll give you just how much I'm spending. And I don't even dare to venture into the nice shops. No, ma'am. I stick to my local discount store, Netto. It kind of looks like a little warehouse, and the staff never smiles, but I guess I digress. So, the rise of the loonie has cooled off slightly since I began working on this feature, but still, the rally our currency has experienced over the last few months is nothing short of amazing. Do excuse me if I'm covering a story that has been beat to death by commentators in Canada, but I thought I'd give you perspective of how the high loonie affects the life of those of us who live overseas. When I came to Copenhagen in August, and before I set up a bank account here, I'd pop my debit card into any local ATM to withdraw money. I usually take out 500 kroner, which translates to close to 100 bucks Canadian. Sometimes it'd be $101 and some odd cents, other days it would be $99 and a lot of cents. But then, a few weeks ago, when the loonie reached an all-time high of $1.10 American, I thought I'd go online to see just how much I was saving. I mean, I knew it wouldn't be that much. After all, the rise of the loonie hasn't been so much an attribute of our government doing things right, as much as the US economy slipping into further recession. Therefore, the gains of the Canadian dollar to the euro, for example, have not been nearly significant. And since the kroner is pegged to the euro, my hopes weren't all that high. However, the savings are significant. Almost 7% to be precise. So, Why is this such a big deal to me? I guess you'd have to be a Canadian exchange student living in Denmark to really understand. You see, the cost of living here is about 25 to 30% higher than in Canada. Take any product you like, from apples to school supplies, even haircuts. They're almost twice as expensive here compared to Canada. How do the Danes survive then? Well, it's a simple case of higher cost of living coming hand in hand with higher wages. Take any crappy minimum wage job, and it'll pay you about 105 kroners an hour. I'll save you the math and tell you that that's about $20 Canadian. No wonder the things are so expensive here. But for those of us, like me, who earn money in Canada and spend it here, the tale is somewhat sad. For that reason, getting to save 7% is a godsend, especially for students like me who count every penny. Now, you won't see me eating out in any 5-star restaurants anytime soon. Heck, I can't even afford a shawarma at the corner. And no, you won't see me sporting bling or grills. But the more favorable exchange rate will certainly make me breathe a little easier, even if only by 7%. For News 101 in Copenhagen, Denmark, this is Peter Otis.
And thanks very much, Peter, for that excellent piece from Copenhagen. Our producer, Megan Turcato, is here now with a look at our oddity of the week. And this week, Megan, you're taking a look at an unconventional wedding ceremony in Winnipeg.
Yes, I am, Jeff. This week, I have a distinctly Canadian oddity for you. Yesterday, Adam Palotek and Jennifer Smith became man and wife at a ceremony at a Tim Hortons in Winnipeg. When Adam proposed, he naturally picked his bride-to-be's favorite spot, which happened to be a Tim Hortons coffee shop, and the couple thought that a Timmy's would do nicely for their nuptials. The groom said everything about the coffee and donut outlet made it a good place to start their lives together. So Adam dropped off a letter at the local Tim Hortons location drive-through window requesting to use the store as a wedding venue. Tim Hortons apparently responded promptly, saying they would love to host the Palotek-Smith vows in one of their franchise locations. On the day of the ceremony, the bride and groom dressed in traditional wedding attire. However, the wedding guests and customers in attendance ate donuts and sipped coffee while the vows were exchanged. The coffee theme, however, did not stop there. Instead of traditional tin cans hanging on the back of the wedding car, this couple had a trail of paper coffee cups. Any thoughts, Jeff, Katie?
Well, instead of saying I do you say I donut? That's pretty bad.
Nice pun.
Then you could, I think it's a great idea. I love Tim Hortons. You could like throw Timbits around, you know, instead of rice. I think it's a great idea.
I don't know. The Vancouverite in me is just thinking, wouldn't Starbucks provide a much nicer atmosphere? Tim Hortons, it's got the ladies and the hairnets and the frumpy brown outfits. Not that I don't love Tim Hortons. No, it's a piece of Canadiana, but...
But you got great food and you got coffee and donuts. What more could you ask for? It's a great time.
Jeff, I don't know if you're making yourself more attractive to the... bachelorettes out there.
All the single ladies out here in Vancouver.
In Tim Hortons.
I'm not saying I would do it, but I think it's a neat idea. I would certainly attend one. Let's just say that.
It could be it would be a wedding to remember, that's for sure. But anyways, thanks very much, Megan, for that piece. Okay, it's break time again, but coming up next, it's the Arts Report with Katie Fitzpatrick. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Hi guys, I'm here to tell you about an exciting social and educational event called the Night of 1,000 Dinners. N1KD is an event held by the International Relations Students Association in order to raise funds and awareness for the campaign against landmines. The evening is a chance for students, diplomats, and members of the business community to come together and enjoy an exceptional meal while discussing and learning about the global landmine crisis. Our dinner has the prestige of being one of the largest student-organized nights of 1,000 dinners in the world. Please join us on November 27th at 6 p.m. at the Marriott Pinnacle in downtown Vancouver. Tickets are on sale now. They're running out very quickly. To purchase, please visit the URSA website at ursa.ca/gala.
And welcome back to News 101 on CITR. I'm Katie Comley alongside Jeff Sargent coming to you live from the Student Union Building at UBC. Thanks for being with us tonight.
Right now it is 5:40 and it's time to turn things over to Katie Fitzpatrick for a look at the arts.
Hello and welcome to your 5-Minute Arts Beat here on News 101. I'm Katie Fitzpatrick. We've got a bunch of announcements coming up for you guys today, and we also have a review in the later part of your 5-Minute Spot. First up in theater, there's Tideline. New World Theater and Touchstone Theater present Wadi Muwad's drama about a bicultural North American man's journey to bury his father in his unnamed native land. That's at the Roundhouse Community Arts and Recreation Center till November 23rd, tomorrow night. There's also Danny and the Deep Blue Sea. Make Our Own Productions presents John Patrick Shanley's play about two troubled souls trying to make sense of their lives. That's at the Beaumont Studios until December 18th. The Red Sisters, being presented here at UBC, is Thompson Highway's comedy drama about seven Native women who leave the reserve in search of the world's biggest bingo game. That is at the Frederick Wood Theater until November 24th, also tomorrow night. Here's an interesting one. Debbie Does Dallas, the musical. Pickled Productions presents a satirical musical version of the 1970s porn flick till November 24th at the Media Club on Cambie. In music, there's Anton Kurti. The 2007 Schumann Prize winner plays works by Chopin, Scherzny, Haydn, and Schumann. That is tonight at 8 p.m. at the Maggie Auditorium. In literary events, there's Snaring the West, readings by William Neal Scott, Natalie Zinn Walcott, and Ryan Fitzpatrick. That is tonight at 7 p.m. at the Montmartre Cafe. Really great place, always puts on some great events. Also this weekend, there's the Writer's Studio, readings of poetry, short fiction, and creative nonfiction by writers from all 7 years of SFU's Writing Studio. That is tomorrow from 7 to 9:30 at the SFU Harbor Center, and also on this weekend is the Jewish Book Festival. Now, a couple things you guys are going to want to keep your eyes on this week in arts events. One of them is Diane Reyes. She's a musician, DJ, and painter, and her exhibit, Nostalgic Dreams, is currently showing at the Zebra Club at 3101 Granville Street, and it runs there until the end of the month. It's an interesting exhibit because it combines her position as a musician and as an artist with her exhibit featuring portraits of musicians, exploring the character of the musician and the relationship between visual art and music. And I'm going to be interviewing Diane actually later today, and I'm going to be airing that interview on Arts Express on Tuesday, the 27th at 2 o'clock. So go check out the exhibit and tune in for the interview. Another thing you want to keep your eyes open for is the European Union Film Festival. Pacific Cinematheque and the Embassy's Consulate and Cultural Institute of the member states of the European Union are proud to present Vancouver's 10th annual European Film Festival, their annual Finger on the Pulse showcase of acclaimed new and recent films from across Greater Europe. Tonight they're showing two films. One is the Slovakian film Two Syllables Behind, which I checked out recently. It was really interesting, an interesting portrait of life in Eastern Europe at the moment, the issue of capitalism and everything like that. But I did feel it left some loose ends. It wasn't completely tied together, but you can check it out for yourself. Another film that I didn't get a chance to check out but is showing tonight is a film called Kiss Me from Portugal, in which a woman decides to escape her mundane life by escaping into a fantasy world in which she is Marilyn Monroe. There's lots of films coming up all the way until December 6th at that festival, so you might probably want to go check that out. And if you email me at arts@citr.ca, you can win a couple passes. Just mention that I mentioned it on the show and we can forward those your way.
And we have a piece from our reporter, Tracy Fuller, on a review of a ballet called Elemental Brubeck.
Maybe it's the academic season that's affecting my artistic perception. But last night, sitting dead center in the audience for Ballet BC's Elemental Brubeck, I started to think of dance as an essay. Stick with me here. Any good dance piece endeavors to express an idea or emotion through movement. That idea is embellished and bolstered when energy flows through the figures on stage, effectively communicating what the choreographer is trying to question. This is done in a variety of ways, using a number of different tricks and techniques. By tricks, I mean costuming, lighting, props, etc. And by technique, I mean the craft of dance, pointed toes and syncopation, and style of dance, modern, ballet, jazz, etc. It was actually my conversation with Simone Orlando, Ballet BC's prima ballerina, that got me thinking this way. Simone is also the choreographer of the new piece Realm of Her Eclipse, which had its world premiere at the Queen Elizabeth Theatre last night. When we were talking about the process of choreographing her new piece, Simone had this to say.
I started off by teaching them a vocabulary that I had made up based on my own improvisations to the music. Mm-hmm. And
clarify, when you say vocabulary, do you mean a vocabulary of movement?
Yeah, vocabulary of movement.
Okay. These are specific forms and...
Yeah, they're sort of phrases of movement that exploring different things. Like one phrase, we had dealt more with sort of footwork and movement from sort of the knee down, and then there were phrases that dealt more with arms and patterns of torso, and we had this large pool of movement to then kind of draw from, and they were sort of given particular tasks to do with the movement, sometimes with a partner, in order to start to generate their own interpretations of the movement and also just their how the movement came together when they were trying to achieve it when someone else was there.
While watching Simone's piece reveal itself on stage, I thought a lot about the vocabulary she talked about, and I was able to see it link together the ideas her dancers were presenting on stage. Simone's ballet, I should say straight out, is beautiful, especially the first and fourth movements. Delphine Leroux is both strong and fragile in the lead role, which Simone herself said was somewhat autobiographical. Serge Benathan's In and Around Kozla Street was definitely striking, but seemed somewhat unpolished in parts. The duet, however, of Alexis Fletcher and James Gunn was so captivating that it was almost distracting and made the other couples on stage pale in comparison. To my mind, Lars Lubavitch's Elemental Brubeck, for which the whole performance is named, was the weakest show in the three-part performance. But then I'm not one for kitsch, and the primary colors and jive and vibe did not arrest me as Kozla Street and Realm did. But the rest of the audience did seem to enjoy it, and so I definitely won't hold it against them. Overall, Ballet BC's Elemental Brubeck is an amalgam of modern dance that pricks the senses and gets the intellectual juices flowing. I would definitely encourage everyone to get out to see the show. It runs at the Queen Elizabeth Theatre until November 24th. For ticket information, go to www.balletbc.com.
And before we go tonight, we're going to check in with our meteorologist, Selena Ferris, for a look at your weekend weather. Selena?
Looks like another variable weekend. A front will be passing through Saturday, so expect showers throughout the day with the chance of snow at higher elevations. Sunday will be cold and clear with a high of 5 degrees and a low down to 0. Expect the clouds to roll back in on Monday with showers and once again the possibility of snow at higher elevations. That's your weekend weather brought to you by the Storm Club at UBC. For more information, you can email us at stormubc@gmail.com.
All right. Thank you very much, Selena. That is our program for today, November 23rd, 2007. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments or give us a tip, contact us. Our phone number is 604-822-5334, or you can email news@citr.ca.
Megan Turcotto produced this radio program. For more news, join us Monday at 5 p.m. for the next edition of News 101. For the entire news team here at CITR, I'm Katie Comley.
And I'm Jeff Sargent. Thanks for listening. Coming up next, it's CITR Sports Friday. Both the men's and women's basketball teams are in action hosting the Thompson Rivers Wolfpack. This is CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.